Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn the conference over to Mr. Andrew K. Park. Sir, you may begin.
Hello to everyone. Welcome to the webinar. We had a few technical difficulties with our audio line, so hopefully people are hearing me right now. If you've gotten in and you've been asked for a code, or you have a colleague that's trying to get in and they ask you for a code, please use the code NFOX. That's N as in Nancy, F-O-X. And everyone should have received the phone line to use to actually get into the webinar and hear the audio. So we apologize for those technical difficulties. Welcome to Trauma Informed Services for Elders with Abuse Histories, presented by Gabby Grant. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Gabby shortly. But first, what I would like to do is thank our partners. This is being held by the National Adult Protective Services Resource Center, the NAPSRC, which is a function of the National Adult Protective Services Association. Our partners are the U.S. Administration on Aging, Academy for Professional Excellence at San Diego State University, and the California Center for Excellence for Trauma-Informed Care. Just a few notes about the National Adult Protective Services Resource Center. We are a three-year grant funded by the U.S. Administration on Aging, and again, administered by NAPSA, the membership organization for Adult Protective Services. We serve adult protective services professionals across the U.S. through research and education. Some of our recent activities been an online survey of APS from all 50 states, and we're proud to report we had a 100% response rate for that. That report will be coming out very soon, very comprehensive look, snapshot of APS nationwide. We also publish research to practice briefs and webinars in addition to the kinds of webinars we're doing today. And the research to practice series is supposed to bridge popular research in adult protective services with those people who are the boots on the ground in the field working with older adults. We also have an APS-specific listserv, which we're very proud of, and this is a great resource for peer support. It's basically one list where you can email your question and get advice from lots of other professionals in APS. If you're interested in joining that listserv, just go to our website, www.apsnetwork.org, and click on the National APS Resource Center, and you'll see instructions there. We'd also appreciate it if you could follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We release news items as they relate to adult protective services on a daily basis. And if you go there and follow us or like us, respectively, we would greatly appreciate that. And if you have any questions about the National Adult Protective Services Resource Center, we'd love to hear from you, and I have our email up on the screen, napsrc@apsnetwork.org. Just a little bit of housekeeping. All the phone lines have been muted, so please use the chat feature to ask questions. And as we move along and at the end of the presentation, we will be reading your questions aloud and having our presenter, Gabby Grant, answer those questions. This webinar is being recorded. The audio portion will be posted on our website. You'll be able to find that in a few days under www.apsnetwork.org. If you have any questions during the webinar that we didn't have time to answer, feel free to use the email I mentioned earlier, napsrc@apsnetwork.org, to ask us those questions, and we'll try to get those answered for you. We'll also be sending out a survey to all the webinar participants asking how we did and how valuable you feel like the webinar was. So just a little bit about our speaker. Our speaker today is Gabriella Grant. She's the director of the California Center of Excellence for Trauma-Informed Care, overseeing all the center's research, program, and professional development, as well as policy. She brings to the center a long history of professional experience, developing innovative programs for female offenders, crime victims, and domestic violence survivors. Through this work, she's also gained an understanding of how program design, policies, and procedures can positively affect the people being served. She got her undergraduate degree from Amherst College. She has a Latin teaching certificate from the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome, Italy, and a master's in public policy from Johns Hopkins. She's taught on the primary, secondary, and university levels and has trained professionals, advocates, and consumers in a wide variety of settings. So without further ado, I will turn things over to Gabby, and she will tell us a little bit about trauma-informed services.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew. And welcome, everybody. It is still morning in California, but maybe many of you are already in your afternoons. And the first thing that I want to do before we get into the presentation is I want to bring your attention to the chat panel. On the right-hand side of your screen, your webinar screen, there's a chat panel. And there's also kind of a bar graphic that is a feedback graphic. Are people able to find that feedback graphic? And if you can, please send a yes answer if you can find that feedback graphic.
It looks like quite a few people are saying yes, Gabby. They can see that.
I see that 11 people have said yes. So there is a feedback graphic which allows for some participation. And another thing that I wanted to do was introduce Lori from California, Della Grammaticatis. And Lori is going to be my partner here. And if you have any questions, you can either refer them directly to Lori or you can just send it to everybody and Lori will read them out. So she will actually vocalize the questions. Lori, are you there?
I sure am. Ready to go.
All right. Wonderful. So we're going to get going now. And we're going to now get going. Thank you all, 23 of you, for saying yes that you found your feedback form. And I look forward to using that feedback form. And so we're going to be talking about older adults who are involved in APS who have prior histories of trauma. And what we're going to do today, Andrew kind of went over my background, so I'll skip that slide. What we're going to go over today is to really understand trauma and these interconnections between earlier experiences, often decades ago traumatic experiences, and how that affects people over the lifespan and especially as we age. We're also going to learn about universal screening, asking about trauma, as well as universal precautions, assuming trauma. And then we're going to review some of the research. So what is that connection between seniors and trauma? Well, first, what we see in the research is that where individuals have experienced prior trauma, especially early in life, that tends to complicate and exacerbate the aging process. So what we see is that older adults face some senior traumas that we can almost expect, loss of loved ones, loss of family, complications in terms of our physical health. But what we see is that when individuals have had earlier experiences of trauma, especially early in childhood or within relationships, for example, that all of those later in life traumas become even more devastating for the individual. And what we tend to see is that the coping, the ability of that older adult to cope with those later in life traumas becomes compromised and unsafe coping tends to increase. So we see this research, and I also want to point out that there is not a lot of research in this regard. So this understanding of early childhood adverse experiences and how it plays out later in life, especially as we age, is really a new field. So if any of you become interested in this, it's very, very fertile ground for exploration for sure. And what we also see where we have research is that where PTSD or the disorder of trauma co-occurs with some of the more common challenges that APS workers struggle with clients who are also struggling, we see worse outcomes. So, for example, when we look at post-traumatic stress disorder co-occurring with depression, individuals who are depressed and also have this disorder of trauma that we can call post-traumatic stress disorder, individuals are more severely depressed, they're more functionally impaired, they have more complicated and persistent mental illness histories, they have higher rates of suicidal behavior and suicidal completes, and they also consume more medical care and are therefore more costly in their own systems. And we see this also with hoarding, another chronic issue that APS workers struggle with their clients. What we see are very high rates of trauma with individuals who hoard. And in addition to high rates of child abuse, child sexual abuse, sexual assault, et cetera, What we also see is a standout trauma for individuals who hoard, that earlier in life, individuals who are currently hoarding experienced having their possessions taken by force. This was either in a foreclosure, for example, during the Depression, during a divorce where families split up and children no longer had their homes, during natural disasters, or, for example, home invasions or robberies. So we do see this standout trauma that individuals who hoard today have experienced this earlier experience of having their possessions taken by force. And then the irony becomes, and this is actually an irony that we see played out over and over again with individuals with complicated trauma histories, is that their current struggle replays, reenacts those earlier traumatic experiences. And now you, perhaps as the APS worker, are now finding yourselves in a position where you're having to take possessions by force, or having to cause possessions to be taken by force. And the older adult not only responds to the current situation, but it is as though they're reliving these situations from the past. So before I go on to some other slides, I wanted to check in. Were there any questions, Lori, or did you have any questions?
I have to tell you that I'm having technical difficulties, and I'm not seeing any questions at this point.
Well, I can, Lori, I can see okay, and there doesn't look like there's any questions just yet. We did have a comment from somebody who's saying, very interesting, we have a lot of hoarders in this area.
Right, and I'm interested to hear, when working with hoarders, have people noticed that individuals who have hoarding behaviors may have had early adverse childhood experiences, including the experience of having had their possessions taken by force earlier in life?
Well, I think at this point, Gabby, go ahead and move on, and we'll track the questions as we move along.
Oh, okay, sure. So we see, when we look at the research, that there is this indication that the behavior of the adult protective services involved older adults who has a trauma history, that there is a connection there. The research is not strong. It's a new field. But we can make this inference. So, for example, one of the things that we can say is that this connection is not by chance. It's not a random occurrence that your client today who's hoarding, for example, who's depressed and suicidal, for example, just happens to have these adverse experiences from earlier in life. We have seen the connection strong enough that we can say that something else is going on. And we do see that there are studies that show that earlier experiences of child abuse and child neglect are a risk factor for older adults to become victims of caregivers and family members later in life. And one theory is that older adults who suffered from physical neglect and abuse in childhood may be more likely to tolerate poor care later in life. That is a theory from this researcher. There might be some other explanations as well. And what we also see is that the experience of a prior traumatic event is a risk factor for elder mistreatment. So what happened in the past, we're seeing this strong connection to what's going on today. And, for example, with this study that looked at older women who had experienced child abuse much earlier in life, we see unsafe behaviors in the present. We see higher rates of substance abuse and addiction issues. We see higher rates of promiscuous and unsafe sexual behavior, particularly related to child sexual assault, abuse. We see a lack of personal boundaries, being unable to allow safe people in, and being unable to keep unsafe people out. Also in this study, particularly associated with child sexual abuse. We also see higher rates of isolation and difficulty trusting or even believing other people, higher rates of humiliation and self-blame for being in this situation, for having these problems, high rates of shame and low self-esteem, not feeling worthy of safety, not feeling worthy of being able to ask for help, for example, an inability to form meaningful relationships, nurturing safe relationships in particular. What this study also found was that women who had earlier experiences of child abuse often what they termed was an inflated sense of power due to the caregiving demands made on the survivor as a child. Another way to understand this is that when responsibility was placed too early on a child, that child tends to develop kind of an over-responsibility, a sense that they are either in control of situations that they're actually not in control of, but that they're responsible for the outcomes regardless. So if something bad happens to their child, that was their fault. Or if something is going on, that they're responsible for that happening. And we also see this sense of not belonging anywhere, a sense of being alien or foreign, even if you're still living in the exact same town that you were born in. So one of the things that we can say is that when you see unsafe behavior in your older adult today, that can be considered a red flag for earlier experiences of child abuse. So the connection has been shown to be pretty strong in the research, but what we also know is that people who've experienced earlier childhood abusive experiences often act out that story as opposed to being able to talk out that story. So when you see things such as re-victimization, and I'm just going to pause here for a second to ask people to ask any studies and to ask any questions, and just to let people know that there is going to be a train coming by, and I can do absolutely nothing to stop this train from coming by. I live in Santa Cruz, California, and we have a tourist train that goes from the beach to the Redwoods, and here it comes, folks. You can now imagine yourselves on the coast of California on this beautiful train.
That's okay, Gabby. Some things are out of our control. We understand completely. We do have a couple questions, if
Great.
That's a good time to talk about those. One is from Steve Casillas. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. Is hoarding noticeable even before the person becomes elderly? Do you have any information on that?
Absolutely. So we see trauma affecting the individual over the lifespan, early in life and throughout their lives. Our focus today, of course, is on the older adult, where we're going to see kind of the culmination of these traumatic experiences, often in physical health. However, you can see it throughout an individual's life, in their relationships, in their jobs, and in particular in their self-care and in their self-talk. So how do people take care of themselves? Are they meeting their basic needs? Are they prioritizing eating, exercise, sleeping? Or are they giving until they have nothing else to give? Or are they denying, for example? And then another key issue to take note of is internal self-talk. Individuals that have experienced a lot of abuse and neglect, especially early in childhood, speak to themselves harshly, often in a similar tone to the way that they were spoken to as children. And then I also notice, Andrew, that there's another question about the ACE study, and we are going to be going over the ACE study today.
Oh, great, great. Yeah, I was going to read that one next, so you've covered that.
Thanks. All right, the train is gone. We're back on track. So when you see red flags in your clients, something that can happen is we think, oh, look at this person. They're so, why don't they see what's going on? Why don't they see these unsafe behaviors? And that frustration, that kind of lack of patience that we might experience is a clue to us that there is a red flag for child abuse going on with this client. So we can even use some of our internal dynamics to kind of have some insight into what is going on with this older adult. So when you see, for example, patterns of re-victimization, that this individual has been involved in domestic violence earlier in life, in their relationships, and maybe even still today as an older adult, but maybe today their abuse experiences are more related to the caregiver or to adult children. Where we see depression and suicidal behaviors clearly linked to earlier experiences of child abuse, shown very graphically in the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. If we see self-harming and self-neglect, also red flags for earlier child abuse. Interestingly, what we can see is that dementia and delirium diagnoses have a higher risk factor when child abuse is present in the life of the individual. So earlier experiences of child abuse increase the likelihood that a person will have a dementia or a delirium diagnosis that often is a complicated diagnosis, and sometimes those trauma reactions kind of complicate that diagnosis as well. Another thing to take note of is that earlier childhood experiences predict that a person will have multiple chronic and complex illnesses. So when you're working with an older adult who, in addition to unsafe behaviors, self-neglect, substance abuse, elder abuse, whatever the situation might be, if they also have multiple illnesses, are taking lots of medication, that is also a red flag for earlier experiences of child abuse. When we see something that we mentioned earlier, not sleeping well, poor eating habits, poor self-care, not bathing, that these are not simply older adult learned behaviors, but are often chronic throughout their lives. And then we can also see this orientation to the world, individuals who are pessimistic, who feel helpless or hopeless or unable to do anything about their current situation. What can I do? There's nothing I can do about it. That these often frustrating responses are indicating these earlier experiences. And then very interestingly, what we also see is that noncompliance is another red flag for earlier experiences of child abuse. Individuals who do not comply with you, the APS worker, who do not comply with their doctor's orders, who do not comply with court orders, who do not comply with the fire marshal's orders, that noncompliance is, again, a red flag for earlier experiences of child abuse. And so I want to, before we move on, let people know that there are some interventions for the older adult population. One is, in case you're not familiar with it, psychological first aid for seniors, which was developed in particular for the aftermath of natural disasters, but can be useful for any kind of stressful event, in case you are interested. Seeking safety has been shown to be effective with the older adult population. This is a specific treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder and substance abuse or other unsafe behaviors, and no clinical license is required for either the first or the second intervention. However, it does require a clinical license in order to do the other ones. Cognitive behavioral therapy for late-life depression, which is a depression treatment for older adults, and IMPACT, which is another depression intervention for older adults. And then we've got just some general information that people might be interested in, responding to violent crimes against persons with disabilities, and preventing suicide and promoting well-being for the older adult population. So there are some resources for people to check into, but we're going to go broadly and really address issues that anybody can ask. So we've looked at this research, the connection between earlier child abuse experiences or abusive relationships earlier in life and being involved with APS as an older adult. And that as a result of that, we can look at unsafe behaviors today as an indication of an individual's struggles earlier in life. We don't actually have to hear that trauma story, if you will. We can notice it in the behavior today. However, what we say in terms of trauma-informed services is universal screening, asking everybody about trauma. Many APS workers say, that's complicated, people don't want to answer it, or people then tell you a whole bunch of stuff that you don't know what to do with. You know, maybe it's best just not to ask. So all of those points are very valid. However, there's also some value in asking. So we're gonna look at asking, and then if you have any questions about it, we'll definitely check into those. So asking about trauma is our next section. A research says, as a recommendation, that when screening for neglect, screen for childhood trauma and poor social support among older adults. So we do have some research background indicating and recommending asking about childhood abuse. There are several universal screening tools that are available cost-free and copyright-free that you might be interested in finding. One is the Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Checklist, civilian version. There's also a military version, and it has been validated for older adults. There is also the Trauma Symptom Checklist 40, which looks at the 40 most common trauma symptoms. There's also something called the Stressful Life Experiences Checklist, and then there's the Adverse Childhood Experiences Questionnaire. These are all validated tools to help you ask. But I'm going to suggest that there's also another way to ask. So you can ask formally using those tools and, you know, get data that might be appropriate for your setting. But if that's not appropriate for your setting, or you want to kind of get a little bit more comfortable in this area first, I can recommend what I call the briefest screen ever. And this is something that you can integrate into a conversation at any point. But do notice kind of where we start and where we end up. So we're going to start with the present. And the question is, do you feel safe speaking to me today? And then the person, you know, might say no, and that would be good communication to find out why they don't feel safe. Maybe they're feeling faint, or maybe they're hungry, or maybe they have a doctor's appointment they have to get to. All good information for us to address before we get into anything else. But, you know, let's assume for our purposes today that the person says, yes, I feel safe speaking to you today, whether or not that's actually accurate. And then the next question becomes, do you feel safe at home today? So now we're going from, do you feel safe talking to me today, to do you feel safe at home today? And here the person can say no. You know, there's mold, there's no hot water, there's no heat, there's a dangerous person, my neighbor's dogs are loose, any number of different situations that might be affecting this older adult's safety. But most people will probably say yes because they're concerned what you might do if they say no. So they might say yes. And then the third question becomes, did you feel safe in your home as a child? I put down here home of origin, but I think that's a little too researchy. And perhaps, did you feel safe at home as a child becomes the question. And if a person says, no, you know, no, I didn't. You know, things were pretty dangerous. You know, World War II was going on, or, you know, I grew up in Britain and there was bombing, or I was born in Japan and there was, you know, a nuclear bomb, or any number of different things might have gone on in that older adult's early childhood. And notice the response that we give to a disclosure of non-safety in childhood. How does that still affect you today? So we're bringing it once again back to the present by allowing them to tell us, you know, in whatever words, about their safety as children, and then to ask them how that still affects them today so that we can really concentrate on what the intervention that APS workers can focus on in the here and in the now while still connecting to what happened to individuals in the past. So I did want to stop here briefly and just check in with Lori. Any questions, Lori?
I am still not able to get into the webinar, so I'm no help there for you, except to note that I love those questions that you've come up with. I think those are very practical to use. Andy, do you have questions?
There are a couple questions that have been brought up, and I think one of the questions goes back to what you were talking about earlier, Gabby. This person asked a simple question, probably a complex answer. Is there help for hoarders?
you know, I think that is there, you know, the answer is yes, and the answer can also be no. And the answer yes is that we can help hoarders cope more safely with whatever item or thing or animal that they're hoarding. Is there a cure for hoarding? Will a person stop hoarding and become kind of a minimalist and an organizer? That's probably not very common. But can we help people cope more safely with some of the issues that promote the hoarding behavior? I think the answer is yes. So that becomes a question of safe coping. And one of the things that I'm not sure that we had available today, but that I'm happy to send to Andrew, for example, and we can post it up with the PowerPoint, are 84 safe coping skills to really have the APS worker focus on how to increase safe coping with some of the issues that the hoarding, you know, the older adult who hoards is struggling with, rather than wanting, for example, a fix or a cure that the person's just going to stop hoarding completely. But it is a very challenging behavior that often began earlier in life and has now kind of progressed to a point where it's overwhelming to just about everybody involved. So I do appreciate the difficulty. So the safe coping skills, I think, come into play there.
Thanks, Gabby. And that was from Kelly Kelly. It's an interesting name. we have another question from Lori Cook Daniels. She says, do you find that people can actually answer how child abuse is affecting them today?
Some can. We're going to get to the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study in a second. And Dr. Vince Felitti, who was the principal investigator, 17,000 Kaiser members in San Diego County were surveyed with the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, and the most common response, and in particular older adults, to the study was, I thought nobody would ever ask. But some people are not going to be able to. The ability to articulate feelings and behaviors, to find these connections, is not available to everybody. But one thing that question really kind of indicates, and I think it's a brilliant question for many reasons, but including this reason, is that asking the question begins the connective process. That if we're not asking, then individuals who have experienced child abuse many decades before will continue to operate under the assumption that what happened to me early in life makes no difference to what is going on with me today. And that just simply is not the case. So even if the person isn't able to say yes, asking the question has a purpose, has a value to it.
There is another question I will put forward during this pause. someone is asking, Dawn Washington is asking, have any of this data been used by APS programs yet, and is there any feedback on how successful they've been to gather the info on past trauma? Are you aware of any?
Well, here in California, we've started to do some work in this regard. Lori, did you want to speak to that?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Andrew?
Yeah, it's... Have any of these ideas or this data been used by APS programs yet, and is there any feedback on how successful they've been to gather info on past trauma?
Thanks. No, I have not heard of anybody making that into a study. It would be a really, it would actually be a really interesting study to see. We have had Gabriella train in 9 different sites in California, you know, we do have in California, we do have a pool of people who've been trained in this, but no research as yet in terms of how that's going.
Yeah, and I also want to just clarify that we're really talking about 2 things here. One is actually getting the data, like, you know, what happened to you, and we're going to be looking at the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study to look more kind of generally at this issue. So what happened to you? You know, I was molested as a child, or I witnessed domestic violence as a child, or, you know, my father died when I was very young. You know, gathering this data, there is essential value to doing that. But what we're seeing is we do not actually have to know that information. So there's value in gathering that information, and it would be good for us to check it out and see, you know, what's going on. But we don't actually have to know. So one of the things that trauma-informed services says is, in addition to universal screening, let's ask about it. Let's make these connections. These connections exist, is that we can also do what's called universal precautions. And universal precautions is assuming trauma is there. If there is unsafe behavior in the life of an individual, an older adult in particular for our purposes today, that we can assume that it has a traumatic experience, a traumatic root, if you will. We don't actually have to have facts to back us up. Now, you might say, is that problematic in some way? Is that somehow unethical, illegal, wrong to assume trauma? Well, I'm just going to ask you to do a thought experiment, just right there sitting in your offices around the country. Many of us are familiar with borderline personality disorder. Lori, I'm just going to talk to you as my thought experiment guinea pig here.
Okay.
So, Lori, are you familiar generally with borderline personality disorder?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, let's say your boss tells you today that you have a new client. Her name is Gabby, and she's got borderline personality disorder. Lori, what is your honest first reaction?
Oh, my goodness. What am I going to do with the other clients I have when this woman's going to take up, 50% of my time? How am I going to handle all of that?
Okay. Nice. Did you also have the feeling kind of like, oh, no?
Oh, yes. there's a bit of terror there. One of my clients that had borderline actually wrote to the newspaper about me and how terrible I was.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah. There's the
and so
thread.
Was another reaction there for, why me?
Oh, yes.
Okay. All right. Great. So many other people across the country in this thought experiment may have had similar honest reactions on the inside. Now, compare this to this scenario. Same boss, exact same client, and your boss says, Lori, you're going to have a new client. Her name is Gabby, and she has trauma-related borderline personality disorder. What changes?
There's more of a feeling of sympathy that this is outside. Even though mental health issues are outside of people's control, there's still an underlying feeling of, they're going to be difficult. This is more, she's a victim feeling.
So in the first one, just simply stating the mental disorder and your reaction, who is the focus on?
Focus on my problem with dealing with her.
And when we added trauma-related, where did that focus go?
It went back to her, what happened to her, why, how was she victimized. It just feels more about her.
Great. Thank you very much, Lori, for participating in that. And so what we see is that when we use universal precautions, when we assume trauma, we just think, maybe there's a trauma reason for this behavior, that we tend to focus more on the client. We have a context within which maybe this behavior makes sense, and we can see some solutions. So rather than I have to protect myself or this is just going to be another problem, we actually have some empathy and focus on some solutions. And so one of the other things that we want to take into note with universal precautions is that if somebody does decide to tell you what happened to them as a child, to recognize that bravery and ask the person what you would like them to do with that information. For most older adults, perpetrators are long gone, situations are long ago. They often say things such as, I just wanted someone to know, and that we can acknowledge that, the bravery in telling that story. But then our line of query, our line of questioning can become, unless there's some other reason, can become, again, to redirect back to the present. How does that still affect you today? I have a hard time sleeping. I'm afraid of strangers. I don't leave my house. I have to keep all these cats around because, you know, I'm afraid that somebody will take them or whatever the situation is. And then another recommendation in terms of universal precautions is that if somebody does make a disclosure of past trauma, that you can speak to your supervisor and even speak generally to your supervisor. You know, a woman out in the field told me this story. You know, I just wanted to let you know so that you can, if you will, in a certain way, counteract some of the secrecy and some of the burden that often goes along with hearing people's trauma histories and trauma stories. And that way you can also make sure that you're abiding by any kind of mandated reporting laws as well. So to become trauma-informed, we want to do universal screening, ask about trauma, using the briefest screen ever, using a validated tool, generally understanding it, but we also want to be present-focused. We want to bring it back to today. And then we also want to use universal precautions. When we see unsafe behaviors, the research really shows us that it's most likely because of earlier traumatic experiences. So therefore, trauma becomes the key to understanding our clients' unsafe behaviors and, parenthetically, our own unsafe behaviors. However, it's rarely on the radar, and you come to a training such as this webinar today, and we think, okay, yeah, it is trauma. I see this. You know, trauma is really important, and it's really significant, and it impacts a person over the lifespan. But once we see that hoarding behavior or the individual who yells at us or the individual who reports us to the newspaper, we tend to forget that context of trauma, and we're just focusing on the behavior. And that's not because we're unempathetic individuals. It really is because our neurobiology, our brain, does not want to think about trauma. It actively attempts to forget trauma. So one of the things that we want to do as workers who are working with highly traumatized individuals is to remember to put that trauma lens back into focus so we can see this behavior for what it is rather than just the surface of what's going on. So we can say that trauma is the most common, the most preventable, and the most treatable factor affecting recipients of social services. It's the most common. When we look at PTSD rates, so this is a pretty high standard. Individuals have to have experienced a life-threatening event that evoked intense fear, and then they have to have certain symptoms that arose from that life-threatening event. So a pretty high standard. But what we see is that as soon as we get into bereaved seniors, we see a fourfold increase in PTSD rates. When we get to World War II vets, again, that fourfold increase. When we look at people in primary care who are sitting waiting to see their doctor, 23% of them meet PTSD criteria. Individuals who are struggling with other mental health conditions have high rates of co-occurring PTSD, often unexplored, undiagnosed. And then once we get into individuals that have, you know, kind of traumatic issues affecting them, we see these even higher and higher rates of the disorder of trauma, all the way to domestic violence victims. That actually, there's a more recent statistic, 86% of domestic violence victims in a sheltered program meet criteria for PTSD. So it truly is the most common factor. Trauma, which is the event, and the disorder, which are the symptoms, affect large portions of the populations that we serve throughout the social services. And it's also the most preventable. So if we can start to see that the later effects of child abuse result in current active elder abuse, problems with health, mental health problems, substance abuse, and homelessness, for example, then we start to see prevention as one of the primary ways to intervene in these later in life social problems. And it's also the most treatable. So we also see that in the DSM, PTSD, which is the current only diagnosis for trauma, you know, that's there, although all the mental health disorders can be related to trauma, PTSD is the one that's specifically trauma-related. And what we see in a meta-analysis of the treatment for PTSD is that about 60% of people with PTSD can be treated and lose their PTSD diagnosis. They no longer have PTSD, 60%. So it's a highly treatable condition as well. And yet many professionals feel that it's a chronic, never-ending, untreatable condition. And many people who struggle with it often feel that it's chronic, worsening, and untreatable. So now we're going to look at the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. But before I do that, I just wanted to check in with Lori.
And I know Lori's having some technical difficulties. There is one question that I can put forward. There's actually been several questions. Maybe get to a couple of them. This one's from Rachel Lake in New Hampshire. Wouldn't assuming trauma overlook behaviors that are associated with medical conditions? Or are you assuming a medical eval has been done and the person has no medical issues?
Well, that is a very, very good question. Whoever asked that question. What we're actually seeing is an effort to let medical professionals know this connection between earlier childhood abuse experiences and later in life medical conditions, so that we can actually not separate these things out, that earlier, and I'm going to show some of this information to you, that earlier abuse experiences result in later in life disease, disability, and social problems. And so therefore, medical evaluators, medical questioners, doctors, nurses would benefit from understanding this connection between earlier trauma experiences and later in life disease and illness, so that they can actually kind of see the full picture as well. So what I'm going to suggest is that it's not as distinct as that question might appear to make these two phenomenon, but there's an interaction between what's going on. And then let's also not forget the aspect of noncompliance with medication and treatment, is that simply, you know, doing an evaluation and telling a person, for example, that they have diabetes and they need to not eat sugar and exercise more, not only is often not an effective piece of advice given by a medical professional, but that when earlier experiences of trauma are present in that individual, the noncompliance rate of that medical advice is much higher. So we see this interaction kind of playing out rather than being singular. So we can focus on the medical issues, and often we should focus on the medical issues because they're pertinent to the person's safety right now, but not without taking into consideration and maybe even just having universal precautions around earlier childhood abuse experiences.
Great, great answer, Gabby. One other question from John Thompson. Any suggestions how APS workers can reduce the chances of their interventions causing re-victimization or reenactment of trauma?
Oh, that is a great and very, very sensitive question. So, and it's a struggle, and you know, we are here in a webinar, so I don't think that we can answer this question, you know, fully to the degree that it deserves. But I just want to point out a couple of things. One is that when we better understand this interplay, this interconnection between earlier adverse experiences and later in life unsafe behavior and unsafe situations and unsafe relationships, we tend to have more compassion for that person, as our thought experiment kind of played out. And in addition to the thought experiment showing us this information, what we also know is that when people feel understood, you know, maybe they won't feel quite so judged, and therefore some of the defenses come out. However, if and when those defenses do come out and the person blames you or grabs onto you for rescue or, you know, does some other kind of reenactment type behaviors, we can understand them for what they are and then respond focusing on this person's safety today. So it's a great question, the more we understand these connections, the more we can have empathy and focus on the solution, and then we can focus on safe coping, that this individual can cope safely with the current situation, feel more empowered, and better able to handle their situations, often in direct contrast to the situation that happened to them earlier in life, and that we're not actually there to magically resolve the problem, but to enhance the inner confidence of that older adult to make safer decisions for themselves. I'm not sure if that totally answered that question, but it's a good one.
Yeah, I think it's good information. And we'll pause the questions for a bit and let you continue.
All right. So we're going to get into the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study was begun out of Kaiser Permanente, HMO, here in California, San Diego, Department of Preventative Medicine, at the Obesity Reduction Clinic. And if you live in San Diego and are obese, meaning that you have a BMI over 30, and you also have a co-occurring health condition such as diabetes type 2, hypertension, high blood pressure, that you will be referred to the Obesity Reduction Clinic. And the Obesity Reduction Clinic has a technology to reduce body weight by 140 pounds, and everybody who reduces the weight by that much loses their medical condition. So they're no longer hypertensive, no longer high blood pressure, and have lost their diabetes diagnosis. But in the early 1990s, the doctors noticed that there was a significant number of people who had lost the weight, lost their medical diagnosis, dropped out of the program, gained their weight back, gained back their medical diagnosis. And this was challenging to those doctors. So they decided to follow up with their dropouts. And they asked them, why did you drop out? And the answers were confusing to the doctors. They heard, I became depressed. I became suicidal. I started to have job problems. I started to have work problems. And this was surprising to the doctors because they did not think there was any negative outcome to losing weight. And so they decided to do more intense histories of these dropouts, and the standout finding was massive amounts of child abuse. And that was the beginning of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, where the doctors wanted to understand, is there a connection between earlier experiences of child abuse and obesity? Is there a connection between earlier experiences of child abuse and other negative health outcomes? And how much child abuse is out there anyway? And that was the beginning of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And what Vince Felitti came to understand as a result of interviewing and surveying 17,000 San Diegoans was that adult diseases can best be understood as the manifestations of distant childhood events. So we're going to look at some of this information. And a site that has kind of compiled a lot of the ACE study and other research related to medical outcomes and earlier experiences of violence and abuse is called the Kaliva.net website. So I do want to refer people to that website to give them some of the research supporting these associations. And Dr. Vince Felitti also says, in understanding these issues, that time doesn't heal trauma. Time conceals trauma. The farther and farther away a person becomes from the traumatic event, the less likely they are going to connect what happened to them in the past and their struggle today. And for our older adults, that is even more true. So the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study asked people these 10 questions related to, did you experience recurrent physical abuse before the age of 18? Did you experience recurrent emotional abuse before the age of 18? Did you experience any contact sexual abuse before the age of 18? Was there an alcohol or drug abuser in the household that you grew up in? Was a household member that you grew up with incarcerated at any point? Did you grow up with someone who was chronically depressed, mentally ill, institutionalized, or suicidal? Was your mother treated violently? Did you grow up with one or no biological parents in the home? And did you experience either emotional and or physical neglect? So I'm going to be sharing some of the research. I've been hoping to share some of this with this man, but the I don't think the video clip works. So he would have told us some interesting stuff. Maybe in a later webinar we'll get that to work. So what we see with the outcomes of the Adverse Childhood Experiences study was pretty shocking and pretty surprising. First of all, they found a strong causal connection between adverse childhood experiences and the development of physical health problems. Causal connection. And then they found this strong correlation, a strong explanatory power between adverse childhood experiences and behavioral and mental health outcomes. And that's going to be our focus today, are the behavioral and mental health outcomes. So we see that the more ACEs a person has, the more likely they will have ever had a drug problem. And please notice that exponential rise. The more ACEs a person has, the more likely, exponentially more likely, the negative outcome. Also, the more ACEs, the more likely the person will ever have been addicted to drugs. The more likely the person will have ever injected drugs. The more ACEs a person has ever had, the more likely they will have ever attempted suicide. The more ACEs a person has had, the more likely they will have impaired childhood memory, being unable to recall important people, places, or events in their lives. The more ACEs a person has, the more likely they will be depressed. Women are red, men are yellow. The more ACEs a person has, the more likely they will have experienced hallucinations. And by the time you get up to 7, you can see that whether a person has abused alcohol or drugs or not, very similar rates of hallucinations. In a certain sense, we can say that flashbacks are a form of auditory and sometimes auditory and visual hallucinations. ACEs and teen sexual behavior. The more ACEs a person has, the more likely they will have engaged in intercourse before the age of 15, the more likely they will have become pregnant before the age of 18, and the more likely they will have become a father before the age of 18. ACEs and the likelihood that a person would have been a later in life victim of rape. As you can see, it says people with an ACE score of 4 or more are over 8 times more likely to be a victim of rape later in life than people with a 0 ACE score. ACEs and being a domestic violence victim. The more ACEs a person has, the more likely that person will have experienced domestic violence. That's very true for women, and we do see a little bit of fluctuation for men. Those numbers were very small and so rather volatile. ACEs and having over 50 sexual partners. The more ACEs a person has, the more likely they will have had over 50 sexual partners. ACEs and having a history of sexually transmitted diseases, not unrelated to the last slide. But definitely associated with the number of ACEs. ACEs and smoking. The more ACEs a person has, the more likely they will be a smoker. ACEs and worker performance. The more ACEs a person has, the more likely they will have called in absent 2 days or more the month before, the more likely the person will be experiencing serious financial problems, and the more likely they will have experienced serious job problems. And then we see this effect on mortality. The more ACEs a person has, as you can see in this slide, that when anybody died during the ACE study, if they reported 0 ACEs, they were more likely to have died after the age of 65. But the opposite is true with the more ACEs being reported. There is an inverse relationship between ACEs and mortality. So one of the things that we can take away from this slide and the APS is that many of the folks that you are working with over the age of 65 have survived and so clearly have somehow managed to cope with the long-term effects of trauma. So that's interesting to kind of contemplate as well. And so we see this relationship played out over and over and over again. The more adverse childhood experiences, the more likely there would be physical, mental, and behavioral health problems in the life of the individual. And the researchers developed a theory. And the theory was The more adverse childhood experiences the person has, the more likely the individual will develop disrupted development of the brain. The more likely the person will then feel impairment socially, being able to get along with people, emotionally, being able to regulate their own emotions, and cognitively, the ability to actually process and communicate information. The more impairments a person has experienced, the more likely they will adopt health risk behaviors in order to calm themselves down. The more likely they adopt health risk behaviors to calm themselves down, the more likely there will be disease, disability, and social problems, including APS involvement, and then we see that effect on the lifespan. The Adverse Childhood Experiences study showed that a person who reports 6 ACEs lives on average 20 years less than a person who reports 0 ACEs. So I was wondering, any questions, Lori? Any reactions, Andrew?
We do have one question from Donna Alberg. Have any studies been done on how treatment of ACE in childhood affects later symptoms in adulthood?
You're right. Great question. So the earlier there is intervention along this pyramid, the less likely the subsequent pyramid will happen. So the first layer is adverse childhood experiences. If we can intervene there, prevention, that's going to have the biggest effect up the line. The earlier we can help a person re-regulate their neurodevelopment, their brain process, the less effect up the line. The more we can affect a person's social, emotional, and cognitive impairments, by understanding what happened before, which was adverse childhood experiences, the more likely we can change things up the line. But I do want to point out that it's not just intervening. It's also understanding from whence that level came. So if I'm just going to look at health risk behaviors, let's say smoking, and I don't understand that adverse childhood experiences affect a person's decision to smoke and continue smoking, my intervention of smoking cessation will not be nearly as effective.
Great. We do have another question from Brad Parks. What does research suggest are the most effective treatments for PTSD in older adults?
Well, that is a great question. And one study that actually had an older adult population that I'm familiar with, and again, this is an area that's fertile for exploration. It's not a well-plowed field, is Seeking Safety. Seeking Safety is an evidence-based intervention that is present-focused that focuses on trauma and unsafe behavior. So, and there have been some studies that have included older adults, and it has been shown to be effective. However, you know, even if we're going to look at depression, which is one of the more common ways for trauma to manifest itself and be noticed by social services, we also want to address depression in the older adult population by still understanding the antecedents to depression, that even if we don't know the complete, you know, childhood history of this older adult, we still want to broadly understand that stressful experiences contribute to depression and focus the intervention on the trauma symptoms related to depression, insomnia, for example, having a very negative worldview, pessimism, nothing will ever change, that these are all common after effects of early traumatic experiences.
Great. Thanks, Gabby. There's no other questions right now.
Lori, did you have any questions or comments?
I just find this all fascinating. One of the things would be what you would suggest to APS workers once they ask those screening questions and find out that there are ACEs in the background. how would you approach that person differently than someone who said, no, everything has been hunky-dory their whole life?
Well, again, we want to ask because there's a connection. We want to break the silence of abuse and violence in interpersonal relationships affecting children and vulnerable individuals in general. So asking the question is important in that regard. Getting the information, if a person chooses to share it with us, is also important. That tells us that this person trusts us, that this person, you know, wants this information to be known. But for the APS worker, I think, you know, and they can tell me as well, I think what's really important is to focus in on the present. How what happened to you in the past is still affecting you today, but things have changed. Help is available. The APS worker is here to help you become safer and to stay independent in your life. So collaboration, cooperation, connection to the APS worker in a certain way, even later in life, is an opportunity to see that safety can be achieved, even though that might not have been the case many, many decades ago. So to focus in on the present, and then to focus in on safe coping skills. And I'll be sending the list of 84 safe coping skills to Andrew, and he'll post it on the website for everybody to use. So to really focus on how can the person cope more safely with the after effects of what happened to them in the past, or with this repetitive struggle that they find themselves in today, hoarding, isolation, poor self-care, abusive child, that the focus becomes on coping. And let's do another thought experiment. And Lori, you're going to be my thought experiment answer giver. Do you mind?
Not a problem.
So let's say right now there was a technological problem. My slides don't work. The audio goes bad. A train goes by, somebody comes into my office, all kinds of things are just going wrong. And Lori, let's say, ask me the question, how do you feel right now, Gabby?
Gabby, how do you feel right now?
Oh, I feel awful. I feel terrible. I feel incompetent. I feel embarrassed. My physical body just is like on fire. Now, let's say that exact same scenario happens, and you ask me the question, Lori, how will you cope with this situation?
Okay, Gabby, how will you cope with this situation?
I'm going to think of the information that I can share with you. I'm going to ask the person to leave. I'm going to focus on the here and now. I'm going to try and recognize that maybe there was a problem, but I can recover. I'm going to apologize for the technology and see what I can do about it. So what do you notice about the difference between those two questions? How does that make you feel, and how will you cope with the situation?
How do you feel, Brittany, just brings out the sort of the negative effects of the situation, but how are you going to cope? Makes you focus on what behaviors you can do to work out the situation.
Wonderful, Lori. Thank you very much. And I don't have any control over my feelings. And, you know, even if I'm having negative feelings, they're still valid, and I don't have any control over them. But I do have control over how I'm going to cope with a situation or cope with my feelings. So one of the things for us to remember as APS workers out in the field is that the feelings related to having APS knock on your door, the feelings related to what happened to you in childhood, all those feelings are valid, but our control, our power to do something about it is in our coping. And for a lot of older adults who have APS knocking on the door, it might even feel like a reenactment of something that happened to them earlier in life where they were helpless, hopeless, and powerless. So as APS workers, once again, we strongly want to focus on coping in the present to help a person feel more powerful and more in control of their situation.
Wow. Yeah, it's very good. I think we could all, that's something APS workers can all use.
Thanks, Lori. I think I've got just a couple more slides here. So one of the things that we can say about understanding trauma in our brief little time together is that what is conventionally viewed as a problem, that person who hoards, the person who isolates, the person who won't kick out the abusive child, the person who gives their money to young things, you know, all of these things is actually a solution to an unrecognized prior adversity. So Lori, let's take an example of an older adult, let's say an older woman who has some money, and a young thing comes around and gets her to invest in his get-rich-quick scheme. How could that actually, that behavior, investing in a get-rich-quick scheme that is unlikely to be a good investment, how is that a solution to an unrecognized prior adversity?
Well, she could have felt abandoned and alone because of neglect as a child, and so having any way to connect with someone and keep them around is a solution for her. It makes her feel better to at least have this guy around, even if she's at least subconsciously realizing that it's not a good financial investment. That part's not as important as having someone in her life.
Who needs her?
Yes.
Who's asking, you know, for her advice through money. Yeah. So one of the things, a suggestion, and I'm going to ask people to just check it out, see what works, is that when you are struggling with a behavior, an unsafe behavior, an unproductive behavior with an older adult, to think first, how does this behavior solve a problem? Because that's the motivator of why that person is engaging in that behavior. And instead, if we simply point out the reasons why that behavior doesn't make sense, why that person shouldn't be doing that behavior, why that person is wrong and needs to do something differently, what we tend to see is people either disconnect from us or tell us what they think we want to hear to get rid of us, or kind of fall into that helpless, you tell me what I need to do, and then blame you when things don't go wrong kind of dynamic. Is this something that you've noticed, Lori?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So let's think first what makes sense about the unsafe behavior, because that's going to give us two important pieces of information. First, it's often connected to what happened to the person earlier in life. And second, it expresses the real need that that person is trying to meet with that unsafe behavior, and therefore maybe we can find safer ways for that person to meet the need. The need is valid. The need is real. But the unsafe behavior, unfortunately, tends to reenact and repeat negative dynamics from the past. So one of the things that we can say about trauma is that trauma, whenever it happens, robs us of a sense of safety and a confidence that we know how to handle situations. Judith Herman says that trauma creates disempowerment and disconnection. Lori, would you find that a lot of people on APS caseloads feel disempowered and disconnected?
Oh, yes. That's one of the things we hear is that, you know, there's really nothing you can do about my problem.
Uh-huh.
You know, I can't do anything about my problem.
Uh-huh.
I'm stuck.
And do you also hear things like, and nobody can help me? There's no one out there to help me?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. That we do hear as well. You know, even when we're coming in to be the helper, there's still the feeling like, you know, you're not going to be able to do anything about my situation.
Thanks. So what we see to become trauma-informed, a trauma-informed adult protective service program or staff person or intervention, is that we want to focus on empowerment, helping this older adult cope more safely with their actual situation and staying in connection with you as an adult protective services, that you actually understand these dynamics. You're not simply judging or telling someone what to do, but that you kind of understand how difficult it all is, but that there is opportunity for change. And then for also older adults to connect with others, that sense of isolation and abandonment and aloneness and loneliness that trauma often creates can be changed. Something can be done about it. So the key becomes safety. Safety is what APS is all about. So some recommendations that I have, although people are free to try them out and see if they work, let me know what works, what doesn't, is to ask about trauma. And that to remember, clients can choose not to answer. That's perfectly fine, because the question tells the value. And then we can focus on the present. We don't have to get back into the graphic details about what happened. We can focus it onto the present. How did you cope? How are you coping? And how does it still affect you today? So we want to help seniors focus on safe coping. We will also want to notice self-talk and self-care, that these are often precursors to the unsafe behavior. I do recommend the Safe Coping Sheet from Seeking Safety. You can download it from the seekingsafety.org website. A little hard to find, so I will be sending it to Andrew for everybody. And then emphasize your agency's mission to help seniors stay independent and stay safe, that your goal is not to judge, but your goal is to help increase safety in the life of this individual. And then remember that these are voluntary services, and that we need to provide some choices for that voluntariness to actually be meaningful. So not just, and you have to do what I say, but here's a couple of options about some services that we have in APS. And this is great news, because APS services are voluntary, and we want to focus on that voluntary, choice-driven aspect of APS. And your services are safety-focused. That's what you're here for, to increase safety in the life of older and vulnerable adults. And that APS services can increase cooperation by giving seniors choices. Would you like to meet with a peer? Would you like us to check in on you? Would you like to come to a group? Would you be interested in Meals on Wheels? That we have lots and lots of services for our seniors. And APS can focus on the present and how the past still affects the senior today. But that's not to give short shrift on actually collecting data about the events of what happened in the past. And that's a really interesting research project, and something that might be very valuable to engage in. And then remember, since no license is required to focus on increasing safe coping and reducing unsafe behaviors today, all APS workers can become trauma-informed, understand the impact of trauma over the lifespan, and help seniors to focus on coping more safely with what happened to them in the past and the real struggles in their lives today. So that's been my webinar for everybody. Any questions, any comments?
There are a couple questions that we can answer as we close things up here. One's from Leslie Brower. Do the data suggest any differences in different cohorts of elders, either differences in prevalence or in therapeutic approach?
Not enough data to say. But generally, if we look not at the older adult population, but we look generally, that we tend to see more similarities than distinctions. So different types of traumas affect people in similar ways, meaning the more unsafe a person's upbringing was, we tend to see more unsafety in the life of the person as they progress through their lives.
Interesting.
How that unsafety manifests itself, substance abuse, isolation, poor self-harm, high-risk behavior, dangerous relationships, that's very individual. But the unsafety piece, very similar.
Great. Here's another question. This might be our last. At what point would it be beneficial for the APS worker to refer the individual to a counselor / therapist who can assist him or her with further development of coping skills? It's from Sherry Lewis.
All right, Sherry. First, I really want to emphasize that APS workers can focus on safe coping. So that is something within the purview of the APS worker. However, giving seniors choices, for example, you know, we have services including counseling or somebody that you can talk to more in depth about what's going on as a choice, you know, you can do that at any point. What I would not recommend, although other people might recommend this, but what I would not recommend is simply saying, oh, if you have trauma, you have to go and see a counselor or a therapist about it, because that's simply not true. People can recover in a wide variety of ways, and the APS worker can help by understanding these connections and giving the safe coping skills to clients and noticing safe coping when they see it.
Great. That's wonderful. I don't see any other questions right now. We did have a few longer questions and a few comments that came along, which I will pass on to Gabby after the webinar. So is there anything else you'd like to add, Gabby, before we close things up?
No, but people are free to check out the website, the California Center of Excellence for Trauma-Informed Care, at traumainformedcalifornia.org. And it was very much an honor to have everybody's attention. Thank you very much. And safe coping for everybody.
Thanks
well, Gabby,
so much.
This is Lori, and I just want to thank you for the wonderful presentation, as well as the real understanding of what APS workers are doing. That's, you know, that's one of the issues that we struggle with, is a lot of times presenters don't understand what APS is about and what we're doing, and that's so obvious from your webinar that you get what we're doing, and thank you so much for a great webinar.
Well, you're welcome, Lori. And I do want to say to you and to all the APS workers throughout the country that your jobs are very important, unrecognized, and undervalued. So any assistance that I can provide, I'm happy to.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Gabby. Thank you so much. This was great information. It was hard for me to take my eyes off the slides to look at the questions because I thought it was so interesting. So thank you so much for this. And there was a question earlier, a bit earlier, about the availability of slides. The audio recording of this webinar, as well as the slides, will be available on our website. We'll post those in a few days. And you'll also get an email asking you to take a brief survey evaluating our program today. And we would appreciate it very much if you could answer those questions for us. And as you see from the very last slide that's on your screen, if you have suggestions for future webinars that the National APS Resource Center can provide, we'd love to hear those. Take those suggestions very seriously. So please do email us at napsrc@apsnetwork.org and let us know what you think your suggestions are for APS-specific webinars. So thanks so much to everyone for your attention. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you soon on a future webinar. Take care.
Bye.